and welcome to Unjustly Maligned, the show for people who go against the grain. We seek to rehabilitate overlooked, ignored, derided, and just plain hated contributions to pop culture. Movies, novels, music, comic books, video games, whatever. If everyone hates it, we'll find someone who loves it and let them explain why you should too. I'm your host, Anthony Johnston, and my guest today is a cartoonist who's spent the past 15 years creating and building the webcomic PvP, one of the most successful cartoons on the internet, and has used that success to branch out into other work, like The Trenches, with Mike and Jerry from Penny Arcade, Table Titans, the semi-official D&D strip, and a lot more besides. So welcome to the show, Scott Kurtz.
Hello, thanks for having me.
It's a delight to have you. So let's get straight to it. Tell us what you've chosen to talk about, and then give us some context around... Well, I was going to say it's released, but this is an ongoing thing, isn't it? So just give us some context around it and why you think it's maligned or overlooked and why, of course, you think that that's wrong.
Well, I have chosen the very popular comic strip Garfield. So it's a little odd because it's not like Garfield is having any difficulties as far as success is concerned. But I've noticed that the comic strip Garfield, and especially its creator, Jim Davis, receive a lot of hate on the internet and from other cartoonists. I've seen it professionally in my industry. It just receives a lot of hate. Garfield tends to be viewed as some kind of corporate sellout, an artist kind of giving up and selling out and going commercial. And I just think that's completely unjust, unfair. I think all the hate that gets sent towards Jim Davis for building a business around his company is unfair. And I've really thought a lot about the psychology of why people that were once fans of Garfield turn on it, where they don't turn on other comic strips. And I have not been able to figure it out yet.
I think it's kind of crazy that people would regard it as a corporate sellout thing. Maybe they just don't know the history because, I mean, I don't know an awful lot about Garfield. It's nowhere near as big over here as it is in the States. But, you know, it is something that Davis created himself and built up himself. It's not something that he did at the behest of a corporation. It's not owned by some... you know, company that he's no part of or anything. It is his thing, isn't it?
It is. And, you know, I think from inside the industry, from other cartoonists, especially other cartoonists who make like a weekly feature for the newspaper, whether or on the web, like I do, I think it has to do with this weird cultural conceit that we have in America when it comes to the comic strip that really is not applied to other forms of cartoon art. You can take a creator and say, you know, Jim Davis doesn't really draw Garfield anymore. He writes it. He kind of sketches it out. But he has a whole team of people that will do the finished art for the strip from the inks to the letters, you know, to post-production. And you'll see them get a weird look on their face. As if it's less genuine, as if it's less involved or pure, because he has a team working on it. But if I tell that same cartoonist, you know, Walt Disney didn't animate every frame of Snow White, or if I say, Miyazaki doesn't draw every panel of every manga he does and doesn't animate every frame, they kind of look at you like, well, obviously, you know. And you know, if I talk to them about the fact that. If I say, you know, who makes the comic strip Powers? They'll say, oh, Brian Michael Bendis. And an artist will say Bendis and Oeming. But no one goes, oh, I hate that comic because Bendis doesn't do everything.
Right.
He hires an artist and a letterer and a colorist and an editor. There's not a disdain for the collaborative process. But for some reason in people's heads, a cartoonist that does a comic strip is a one-man show. And if he pays someone to write a joke, if he hires a staff to help him ink it, he or she is less than. Except in the cases where there's a team, because that's somehow accepted. So it's really an odd psychology that's, I think, 100% cultural. And I'm not seeing it a lot outside the States from other artists. But that's contained within the industry, within people that make comics. And I think a lot of it is jealousy. I think a lot of it is America's cultural tendency to build someone up, and then once they're big, now it's time to tear them down.
Oh, I don't think that's exclusive to America at all. We have it very much have that over here as well.
That's good to hear, because I really thought it was us.
No.
Is it the same way in the UK?
Oh, yeah, no. Exactly the same. Build them up, knock them down.
Yeah, I guess that's just human nature, huh?
I think so.
I think that, and I don't know why Garfield is such a target for this, is I think that most people, when they're children in the States, read Garfield and love Garfield. I think it's, as far as reading comics, it's kind of like a first step. People, I can't tell you the number of people that I know that grew up reading Garfield and loving it. But now they think it's dumb, and they think it's trite, and they think it's really dumb, and it hasn't made them laugh in forever. And my answer to that is, well, yeah, duh. I mean...
Yeah, you're not a kid anymore.
You're not a kid anymore. So, but what's really interesting to me, and what I find fascinating, and what I really try to examine mentally a lot, is people don't have the same attitude towards Peanuts.
Right.
Yeah, Charles Schulz is regarded as artistically pure. Snoopy is considered just this grand, you know, just so smart and amazing. And, you know, I think it, I've even had people say that they read the Snoopy comics and feel like it's a little tired. But I think what people forget or don't realize when it comes to some of these comics, especially with Peanuts, it's like when after the Matrix movies came out and they were really groundbreaking because no one had done bullet time. They kind of invented that bullet time,
yep,
where you set up a circle of cameras and you film something where you spin around it 380 degrees while it's frozen in time. And I mean, everyone lost their minds, but then it just became...
Suddenly everybody was doing bullet time.
Yeah. So, I mean, if you're in your teens now and you've been watching movies and someone shows you The Matrix for the first time and you're like, oh, dude, you got to watch The Matrix. You're going to watch that and go, what's the big deal?
Yeah.
Well, because you didn't experience it happening for the first time. Yeah. Peanuts, Charles Schulz is the first guy to have kids talk like adults in the comics. I mean, it's the first time it ever happened.
Right.
So you have these little children walking around talking like adults. It was groundbreaking. I mean, there's a reason why it just became, you know, so popular. And so... You know, now everyone does it. So when you show a kid Peanuts, they're like, I guess I understand why you think it's so great. And I, you know, I think the same thing goes for Garfield. You know, Garfield was the first really slick post-Peanuts, you know, animal strip where the animal kind of had an attitude. I think Heathcliff might have come before it, but I don't think Heathcliff talked. And it was a one-panel strip. But I think a generation of kids really latched on to Garfield. Now, what's really interesting about Garfield from a business perspective is that, and comparatively to Peanuts, which has arguably probably made the most money ever of any comic strip, what happened is in the 70s. So the way the syndicates work when you do a comic in the newspapers is there's maybe... I mean, back in the 60s and 70s, there were more. But right now, there's about three. But there were anywhere from 5 to 10 major syndicates in the country. And they had relationships with all the newspapers. And they had salespeople, actual people with suits and fedoras that would travel the country and go from paper to paper and sell features to them. Syndicates represented comic strip artists, articles, columns like Dear Abby and Ann Landers, you know, editorial stuff. Mm-hmm. But the comic strips were a big draw. They were big, huge competitive leverage for newspapers. And in their heyday, newspapers were purchasing the rights to have comic strips in their town over other papers, even if they didn't have room for it. So sometimes you'd have, you'd as a cartoonist, being paid for your comic strip by a newspaper that wasn't even running it, just so the other newspaper in the town, the competing newspaper, couldn't have it.
Oh, wow. That's terrible. Can you imagine being in that position? I mean, yes, everybody loves money, but as a creator, you want people to see your creations.
Ironically, most cartoonists would kill for that situation to be back again, because what's happened since then is that there are no competing newspapers. A big corporation owns all the newspapers in any given state, if not multiple states. Mm. There's no competition. And whereas the newspapers used to have a specific editor for the comics page that loved it and curated it, now it's a job assigned to someone who obviously doesn't want it and who's already editing three other pages and is only going to be editing the comics page for a week. I mean, they're shrinking and shrinking and shrinking in both number of strips and size. So, but in the heyday, in their heyday, cartoonists were, especially in the 40s and 50s, they were rock stars. I mean, they all wore suits. You might see them invited to, you know, like movie premieres, is like you'd see a movie star invited. I mean, they were huge.
Wow.
In the 60s and 70s, the money in the 80s, the money was great. I don't know if they were as socially the rock stars they were in the 40s and 50s, but you know, the money was great. I mean, I think the comic strip was invented by William Randolph Hearst to sell papers. Hmm. So, and it's but what's interesting is that so when you sign a deal with a syndicate, because no newspaper is going to buy your comic strip without being rep by a syndicate, you were entering a contract anywhere from 10 to 25 years.
Wow.
With the syndicate. Mm-hmm. And they took half of everything. So you just straight up give them half of the rights to your comic.
And everything that strip is going to earn you for the next 25
years. Everything.
Wow.
Everything for the next 10 to 25 years. So what happened was in the 70s, 70s or 80s, I'll have to look it up. I should have done research. He purchased back his rights to Garfield.
Jim Davis did.
Right. From the syndicate. Jim Davis. Jim Davis, Garfield was making so much money that he purchased back from the syndicate his rights.
So even though the syndicate was taking half, he still made enough to be able to purchase back the rights, because that can't have been cheap.
No, it wasn't. And I asked Jeannie Schultz, the widow of Charles Schultz. I was invited out to the museum and to give a talk, and we were discussing it. And I said, you know, why didn't you guys ever buy back the rights to Peanuts? I mean, obviously you had the money. You know, if Davis could do it, if Davis could afford it, certainly you guys could afford it. Mm. And she said Sparky wasn't interested.
Huh.
Charles Schultz just wanted to make the comic. He didn't want to worry about that stuff. And I think at the time,
well, and the business didn't dry up before his death, did it?
No,
so
hardly.
He had no reason to think about it. Maybe Jim Davis saw that, you know, saw the way things were going.
Yeah. So in 1981, what Jim Davis did is he started a company called Paws, P-A-W-S, Paws Incorporated. And he built the company to support the comic strip and its licensing. And he built a big compound out in Muncie, Indiana. He has a staff of like 50 artists and licensing people. In 94, I'm sorry, is when he purchased all rights to the Garfield comic strips. He bought them the rights from 78 forward to 93. He mm-hmm. bought the rights from United Feature, the rights to Garfield. However, the original black and white strips, the art, remained copyrighted by the syndicate. So they still had the right to, anyway. Jim Davis built an entire company around licensing Garfield. So
those ubiquitous Garfield toys that you see on the people's
everything.
Windows in the back of their cars. Yeah.
Right. So everything from the suction cup Garfields to, and that might've been before, but But basically, Jim is more like a webcomic artist who were traditionally syndicated cartoonists, you know, just like I said, what Charles Schultz said, look, I'm an artist. I make comics. I don't run a business. That's for my syndicate to do. I sit at a board and I draw my art and then I get money for it. And that's it. And it's pure. Jim said, I'm going to do everything. I'm going to hire a staff. I'm going to run the licensing. I'm going to approve, proposals. I'm going to, look over everything everyone's doing. I'm going to write the strip. Someone else is going to draw it. And he's got his hand in everything, which is more what like a traditional webcomic artist does, because you know, a webcomic artist has to do everything. They don't have a syndicate. So they run their business. They make merchandise, they sell merchandise, they do their taxes, et cetera, et cetera.
It's also a very George Lucas-like approach.
Exactly.
The whole reason that Star Wars was a massive hit because it was a great film, sure. But the whole reason that Lucasfilm became a powerhouse was partly because Lucas kept a large proportion of the rights, but also because he kept all the rights to the merch. Not just the movie, the merch. And that was what built Lucasfilm's fortune.
Yeah, and it's what... And it's what started Lucasfilm and ILM, and Pixar was a Lucasfilm thing that
yes, that's true.
Yeah, I mean, so again, another example of where you'll say, why do you have no disdain for George Lucas? And they're like, well, obviously one person can't make a movie. Well, actually, one person can make a movie, but why is it okay for George Lucas to do this? Why is that not selling out? But for Jim Davis, it's selling out. And, I've not been quiet about my admiration for Jim Davis and my desire to follow in his footsteps, both artistically and business-wise. Like, I'd love to build my own paws. I'd love for anyone to give a damn enough about my comic strip so that I could license it and build a company around it.
So Garfield was an influence on your decision to, I mean, was it an influence on your decision to become a creator, right in the beginning, as well as how to conduct your business?
Well, from the very beginning, Garfield didn't just inspire me to make comic strips. I mean, aesthetically, I was attracted to the art immediately. So it all started when my mom bought me the first Garfield collection. It was Garfield at Large. It was the first book.
I think I may have read that one myself, or at least a British collection with the same title. Yeah.
Yeah. It was a red book. It said Garfield at Large with white text on it.
Sounds right. Yeah.
So in 1978, the very first Garfield strip, and I don't know if he ever followed up on it, but the very first Garfield strip was the character of John introducing himself and Garfield. And the first line of the strip is, hi, my name is John. I'm a cartoonist, and this is my cat, Garfield. And I remember reading that and thinking, well, what's a cartoonist? So I asked my mom and my dad, and they said, well, a cartoonist is someone who makes comic strips for a living. And it was the first time it dawned on me that there was someone's dad who his job was he made comic strips. Mm-hmm. Like, my dad went to work and was an engineer and an estimator, this guy's dad stays at home and makes comic strips. And I was like, well, I want that to be my job. Like, I want that. And so the really weird thing for me about Garfield was it didn't just inspire me to want to draw. It really put the notion in my head that there was this, this job where you could grow up and be a cartoonist. So, you ask a third grader what they want to be when they grow up. Ask anyone, what did you say when you were in the third grade you wanted to be when you grow up? Did you become that?
How old is third grade?
Oh, let's see. I would say, in the third grade, I had just moved to Des Moines, Iowa. So I would say eight or nine.
Okay. When I was 8 or 9, what did I want to be? I think I was already starting to doodle myself at that age with comic stuff. But I think primarily by that age, I was probably convinced that I was going to be a singer.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's awesome. Well, I knew I was going to be a cartoonist. My uncle worked as a career counselor at a college in California called Cabrillo College. And so he helped students decide, you know, what jobs to take after they graduated. And I called him and asked him if he had any information on becoming a cartoonist. And he did. He had an interview, a photocopy of an interview with, believe it or not, Jim Davis.
Oh, that's amazing.
So he sent that, he mailed that to me, or maybe I was visiting and he gave it to me. I don't remember. But I had this little printout of an interview, and it had a photo, which is like, you know, a Xerox of a Xerox of a photo.
Sure. Yeah.
But I remember my mom taking me to an art store and me saying, I need everything on this desk.
Wow.
Like, I don't know what that is. And I'm like, well, that's a T-square. And I'm like, well, what does that do? And it says, well, it helps you draw, you know, perpendicular lines. I'm like, what's that? And they're like, well, lines that are like 90 degrees to each other. And I said, oh, that must be how he draws the boxes. I need one of those.
Right.
You know, what's that? Well, that's a crow quill pen. Well, I need one of those. Well, I don't know what tip it is. You know, there's 100 tips to a crow quill pen, but you dip it in the ink and that's how he inks it. And I'm like, all right. So now I'm on a quest. What pen tip does he use?
Ah, yes, the rabbit hole that all creators go down. What do my favorite creators, what's their equipment? Yeah.
Right. That's going to make me famous. And so my next quest was to contact Jim Davis via letter and see if he would create characters for me. Because I was convinced that if he could create my characters for me, then I could write the comic.
Wow.
But I didn't think I could come up with characters on my own. And then a new book came out, and there was an interview at the beginning of it. Like, people had submitted real questions, and he answered them in the front of the book. And some kid had asked, could you create characters for me? And I was devastated that someone had asked first. I'm like, oh,
this
oh,
was
God.
Before you sent a letter to him.
Right. Yeah, no, I had not steeled myself to send the letter yet. Or find out how to.
Right.
And he said, creating your own characters is the best part of the comic strip. I wouldn't steal that from you.
Right, right. I wouldn't deprive you of that joy.
Right, yeah. That's the most fun part. And so I went, oh, okay. Well, then I'm glad I didn't write the letter. Because that would have been embarrassing. That's although, funny that I remember all think, this.
Come on, what a memento that would have been to have a reply to that letter.
I know.
Framed Jeez, on your I wall probably, right now, you know?
I probably wouldn't have kept it, but at the time. And then there was a moment where my mom actually, for about a week, tried to take Garfield away from me because I flipped out. We were watching the news, and I think Empire Strikes Back had just come out. And some kid knew so much trivia about Star Wars that he wrote it all down, and a publisher publishes a book. And so it was this big news story about this kid. He got a book deal because he knows so much about Star Wars, and he was 13. And I'm like, oh my gosh, he's 13 and he has a book published? I'm behind. Like, I need to work harder on my comic strip because, you know, it's all passing me up.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is really funny because, I mean, you know, as someone who's works in comics, you know, there's that weird feeling when you're trying to, quote, break in,
mm-hmm.
where it feels like everyone's breaking in and everyone's passing you by.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. My entire career, I've felt like that.
Yeah, you always kind of feel like it. But I guess for me, it started at younger than 13 because I remember thinking, oh, I just don't, there's not enough time between now and 13 for me to get good enough to have a book published. And my mom was like, all right, you're taking this a little too seriously. I think you need to. But she couldn't stop the art, man. She couldn't stop the art. But yeah, so like all my first comic strips I ever made were essentially Garfield knockoffs. And
oh, sure. I did that when I was like 11 years old as well. Yeah. Everybody does that.
Everyone does that. So there was a TV show. Actually, I think it might have been a British import. It was called Bagpuss. It was a little puppet.
Yeah, yeah.
So I used to make Bagpuss comic strips.
Really? Oh, my goodness. Do you have any of them?
I don't. I wish.
Oh, man. Yeah, Bagpuss is like, that's a cultural institution over here.
Right, but in the States, no one had heard of it. So I could make Bagpuss comic strips, and everyone thought that I came up with it. because I don't remember where I saw it, maybe PBS or something.
Right, sounds about right, yeah.
The idea being that one day I could write the makers of the show and say, hey, I have this comic strip, let's put it in the paper. But yeah, Bagpuss. Gosh, I totally forgot about that until just as I was talking to you.
I can't believe you had a careers guy who, when you said, I want to be a cartoonist, didn't immediately just say, don't be so silly, and send you down the nearest factory line or something, you know? Because that's pretty much what happened to me. I went
to, really?
Yeah. I, you know, we had careers fairs. And what would you like to do? Well, I think I'd probably like to maybe be in a rock band or draw comics. And they were like, yeah, off to the factory with you.
Off to the factory?
Yeah, it was like, don't be silly. Nobody does
Wait
that.
Wait a minute. What's this factory? Explain the factory.
Oh, just any factory, you know. Doesn't matter. Just don't get ideas above your station, you know.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, don't be silly. People like us don't do that sort of thing.
Yeah. No, I never had that problem. I think the closest that I ever got to discouragement was I overheard my dad asking a neighbor who was an illustrator if it was possible for he's like, you know, my son wants to be a cartoonist like Garfield, the guy that's Garfield. And he's like, yeah. He's like, yeah, what are the odds? And the guy said to my dad, Frank, the only people that succeed at that stuff are the people that are too stupid to realize it's impossible. And at the time, I thought it was an insult, but I think it was a compliment.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, that's an absolute, you can apply that even to regular comics these days. You know,
yeah.
It takes so much sheer tenacity and determination to get anywhere at all, that you have to be completely blind to how difficult it is.
Yeah, and I've always been that way. You know, I've always been, you know, all through high school and college, you know, I lived the bull crap lie that, no, I'm going to get a day job and I'm going to, you know, obviously cartooning is just a hobby, but I would always say to myself, yeah, no, I'm going to be a cartoonist. I mean, that's going to happen. I'll show them all.
Yeah.
And I don't think anyone ever really doubted it. No one ever discouraged me, but I knew it was crazy to say, well, I don't need to go to college. I'll just become a cartoonist. I still went through the motions, but I didn't care.
Right.
You know, yeah. I just didn't care.
Talking about dates, you said that that Jim Davis bought the rights back in 1994.
Mm-hmm. According to Wikipedia.
Which is, and I said earlier, maybe he saw the writing on the wall. That date, because that's a bit later than I realized that had happened. I mean, that's kind of coincident with the rise of the internet. You know, the World Wide Web was invented in 93, I think, or 94.
Four years later, I was starting my comic strip online. So.
Yeah. So maybe he was quite prescient.
I think so. I mean, he's always been kind of hip to that kind of stuff. There was a guy who took Garfield strips and removed Garfield from them.
Garfield without Garfield, yes.
Garfield minus Garfield. And what he ended up doing was making a comic strip that was less about a cat and more about the mental disorder of a guy named John. Yeah. And it became really popular on the web, and obviously Jim saw it. And instead of getting pissed or telling him to take it down or sending a cease and desist, he offered the guy a book deal and he published it as a book.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh my goodness, I didn't know
There's
that.
There's an official Garfield minus Garfield book. Jim thought it was hilarious.
Oh, I knew, I'd heard that he'd seen it and sort of said, actually, you know, I'm quite amused at this. This is great. But I had no idea that he had published a book of it.
Uh-huh.
Oh my goodness.
You can buy it on Amazon.
That is amazing.
And it says, by Jim Davis.
Of course it does, which mm-hmm. goes back to the whole studio thing. And I wanted to sort of speak up about that, because I've heard that as well. People saying like, oh, but he doesn't even draw it anymore. If like anybody out there who isn't in the industry, but, you know, reads comic books or cartoon strips or manga or anything really, should know that just about every commercial art industry even the fine art industry in the world employs uncredited assistants.
Oh, like, everyone.
You don't think Damien Hirst actually builds all that stuff that he makes for these huge installations? None of them do. And that's not to take away from their talent and the vision, but they are the visionaries. They employ assistants to actually make these huge installations. And mangaka employ massive studios, as you know, dozens of assistants to meet their insane deadlines.
Yeah, they have 18 pages a week they have to do.
Yeah. Even artists in the US mainstream industry use studio assistants. There are people who spot blacks. There are some people have full-on pencilers whose work is credited to the, you know, the brand name artist. I'm not going to name any names here because it's not important. The point
it's
is
not.
That
it's really
this
not.
This is a like, really widespread practice.
Yeah, it has to be. And I think it's one of those things where it all comes down to, you know, perception versus execution. And it, you know, at some point, there's a really good documentary about 3D printers, the rise of the 3D printer. And it follows four or five people trying to start 3D printer companies. And the one that does the best, MakerBot, you watch it go from, inevitably, from these guys with a vision that aren't going to be beholden to anyone to, you know, corporate sellouts.
Right.
And I say that term for lack of a better term, but you can't be MakerBot and be four guys in your garage. You know, right. At some point, to become the corporation, you have to become a corporation, and a corporation is a very different beast than, you know, a rebellious group of guys in their garage.
Yeah.
If you want to be, if you want to be rebellious guys in your garage, you can be.
But you can't then be a company that makes and distributes products all over the world.
Right. Do you ever watch Dragon's Den?
No, but I know what it is. I'm well aware of it.
Okay, because here it's called Shark Tank in the States.
Oh.
I know. In Canada and in the UK, it's called Dragon's Den, which is a much better name. But one of the things they always tell entrepreneurs is, you know, you have a hobby. You don't have a company. And or they call them wantrepreneurs instead of entrepreneurs, which I think is kind of crappy. But, you know, there's a difference between a hobby and a business, or a product in a business. And they're always telling people, like, look, you're doing great. You're doing awesome. You can support your family. This is your business. It's wonderful. It's not a corporation for someone to invest in and get a return on. And if it becomes that, you're going to be unhappy. Like, this is fine the way that it is. But if you want to become the next big thing, you have to change who you are. Now, when you take a look at something like Garfield, that went through the syndicate system, I think that happened to Jim, whether he wanted it or not. You know, I think the most Jim ever did was make his comic strip as best as he could. Mm-hmm. You know, it became this giant thing, and he could either let the syndicate handle it, or he could shift to handle it himself, and he chose to handle it himself, which I find admirable. I think the selling out part would have been if he had sat in his office and just kept drawing it and let the syndicate, this big machine, do everything, you know?
It's going to happen anyway. Those cuddly toys are going to get made one way or the other.
So absolutely.
Who makes them? Who profits?
Right. But now you have Jim at the helm of it, and you get cool things like Garfield minus Garfield. And Jim is very aware. I highly, highly, highly recommend that everyone go to Netflix right now and watch the documentary Stripped. Stripped is a documentary about kind of the rise and fall of the American comic strip and the rise of web comics. They interview a ton of people. And you can watch it for free on Netflix. My friend of mine, Dave Kellett, and his buddy Fred Schroeder made this documentary. Dave is a web cartoonist. But if you look online for Stripped, he has posted for a very nominal fee the raw interviews, unedited.
Oh, wow.
And you can watch an almost two-hour interview with Jim Davis. I highly, highly recommend it.
Illuminating, is it?
Very illuminating. Jim Davis is a year ahead on Garfield.
Wow.
The comic he makes today is going to come out a year from now. He is 1 year ahead.
That is crazy.
He still writes and sketches out every single comic strip. He sketches it on the Cintiq in very broad strokes, but he writes the comic. Every comic is under 25 words.
Really?
Yeah. For some reason, he feels like it needs to stay under 25 words.
Oh, has it always been under 25
words? I think so.
Wow.
I couldn't do it. But
neither could
and
I.
his goal, and he talks about it more than once, is still to make a comic that makes the whole world laugh. Like, that is still his goal.
And can we just point out, we've gone a long time talking about, you know, Davis and Garfield without really touching on something that is very important, which is, it is a funny comic strip.
It is.
You know, it is, yes, okay, it may not be as funny to you now as it was when you were 10 years old, but it is funny. They are good jokes.
No, it really is. And Corey, our mutual friend Corey, whose episode you're afraid to edit, I was at his house last week, and he has a current Garfield up on the refrigerator, and it's hilarious. It's really, really good, and it's well done. But I think that, again, culturally, people look at the comic strip and they go, well, this is the guy with the plush dolls and his own company and Garfield's everywhere, and it's not cool to like it anymore, so I'm going to take a crap on it. But I think secretly, they read the comic strip and they laugh. And you give Garfield to kids now and they love it just as much as a kid like me that read it in the late 70s, early 80s.
Which is something else that I was going to mention. You said that people, as they grow older, you think there might be a certain amount of jealousy, certainly on people within the industry, masking, you know, being masked by these accusations of corporate sellout and stuff. And one of the things that I like about Garfield, and Peanuts was like this as well, and a lot of cartoon strips are, is that it is completely timeless, and it doesn't care about fashion, and it doesn't change with the whims of fashion or what's trendy. And I've always got this feeling, you know, this hard to quantify feeling that Davis just does not care about those sorts of fashionable ideas. He doesn't want it to change. He doesn't want to stay current or trendy. And I think that infuriates people sometimes, because, you know, people will make these calls for like, oh, you're not relevant anymore. You know, you're all part of the old guard, blah, blah, blah. And meanwhile, he's just there doodling away, doing the same thing that he's always done and just not caring.
Yeah. He gives no mind to it. And he really, adheres to a very pure philosophy of trying to make people laugh and being universal and reaching as many people as possible. Again, his goal is to make the whole world laugh with a comic strip. Mm. That's his goal. So he's trying to, he's trying to get there, and he's not going to do that by making a Kim Kardashian joke.
Exactly.
You know, he's not going to do that. And plus, he can't, because the comic strip he made about Kim Kardashian today is not going to come out for a year, right? And no one will care about Kim Kardashian in a year. I mean, it's fascinating to see how this whole operation works. And I'm really excited, because we have a friend that works at Paws, and I'm trying to work it out. He wants to give us a tour and let us meet Jim, Corey and I, and we're going to try to fly out to Muncie and do it. But this friend of mine, his name's Dave Reddick. He's a cartoonist. He has his own comic strip called The Intelligent Life that just got syndicated. But Dave works at Paws, and for the 10th anniversary of PvP, he got me a gift. He had introduced Jim to PvP, my comic strip. Mm-hmm. And he's like, you got to check out this comic. You know, it's a friend of mine. His name's Scott Kurtz, and he does this comic called PvP, and I think you'd really like it. And in an interview right after that happened, someone asked Jim, like, are you paying attention to the web? And he's like, oh, it's fascinating. That's where all of the new creators are coming from. I'm looking over my shoulder at these guys. And he said, there's a kid named Scott Kurtz, and his the timing on his humor is flawless. And I almost fell out of my chair reading it. And David sent a picture, a drawing Jim did for me, and it's framed and downstairs above my my Cintiq. But it's a picture of my character, Scratch Fury, an orange tabby cat that's in my comic strip, my orange tabby, inspired by his orange tabby. But Scratch and Garfield are back to back, and Garfield says, "We cats have to stick together." And, you know, Jim drew that for me. And boy, it came in the mail, and Brian and I, my brother and I, just unboxed it so gingerly, and and we just stared at it and observed. And I mean, we went and bought a lamp, but because we had a desk lamp, but we needed a second one because if you tilted it, the art on the side, let the light hit it, you could see the raised ink. And we're trying to, like, because I mean, it looks so clean.
Yeah.
So, I mean, and we were trying to dissect the line art. Boy, I get emotional talking about this picture. But just the brushwork on it, everything. It was impeccable. God, it was just fascinating to look at it. It's my prized possession. But who does that?
Yeah,
I mean, especially considering that in my career, for the most part, I've got nothing but disdain from syndicated cartoonists and to my own doing. Because I made a lot
You've been outspoken.
I've been a real jerk. I've had a real chip on my shoulder after one incident that I decided was going to make me an angry young cartoonist. But what's funny about Jim is he's literally above it all. Like, he does not participate in any of that stuff.
Yeah.
So it totally missed Jim, thankfully. But yeah, I've been an admirer of his since I was a child. You know, he still, I don't think there's many cartoonists that work as hard as Jim. He's overseeing a lot. He's running a company. He's still making his comic strip every day. Most cartoonists that do syndicated features don't want to do any of that. I mean, they just don't even want to do it. Jim's busy approving. I think in the interview I watched, he just got done approving a manga version of Garfield that's going to appear in Japan.
Oh, wow.
You know? So, I mean, I'm just like, ooh, I've got to see that.
And he's been doing this for almost 40 years now. As we record, he just celebrated 37 years, I believe.
37 years of Garfield, yeah.
Yeah. 40 years. And to the best of my knowledge, no repeats, no reruns. Every strip is new.
I don't think he ever has, no. I mean, when you're a year ahead, I don't think you have a problem with it.
Right. But, you know, at some point he had to be, whether you're a year ahead or not, that's still 37 years of new strips.
Uh-huh.
That's amazing.
Yep. And he got his start interning for Tom Ryan. He was assisting Tom Ryan, who was a cartoonist at a comic strip called Tumbleweeds. And he kind of, back in 69, so he got his start in a mentor, mentee position, which sadly is in the States, a practice that has been lost.
I don't think there are many apprentices over here anymore either. Yeah.
I just, the whole idea of the fact that we're so college driven and we're not apprentice mentor driven as a society is, I think, sad to me, especially in the creative fields.
Mm.
He had a comic strip called Norm Nat that ran 5 years in a local newspaper in Indiana, but the syndicate never...
didn't pick it up, yeah.
No, they said his art was good and his strips were funny, but you can't... No one can relate to bugs. and so he did...
probably right.
Probably right. And then he created Garfield. And since then, he did another comic strip called U.S. Acres. I don't know if you ever...
No.
Saw that, but he grew up on a farm and he did a barnyard comic strip for a while.
Oh, okay.
They made a cartoon about it too. So Jim's done a lot. He's done a lot. And I admire him very much. And it really bugs me when people default to, I don't know how the reputation got built as him being someone that is less than as a cartoonist.
Mm.
He is anything but less than.
Okay, so where's a good place for, like, I read Garfield as a kid, you know, I read the book compilations. I don't think it was ever in any newspapers over here, but I did read those compilations as a kid, Garfield at Large and stuff, laugh my head off. I confess, I haven't read a Garfield strip in 20, 30 years. So where's a good place for somebody like me who's familiar with it, but not at all current? You know, where's a good place to sort of dive into?
I don't think Garfield is a property that you have to be current on. I think you can jump in anywhere. I think you can buy a book. I think you can buy any book. I know there's a big web presence. I know Garfield.com has a ton of stuff. A lot of it's probably for kids.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as the comic strip itself is concerned, if you're just an admirer of the American comic strip and Jim's work in particular, I would tell you to go, let me see. I'd go to Amazon and buy any of his books. I highly recommend that you buy two Garfield books. I would buy the very first one, Garfield at Large, because the strip was very different then.
Mm-hmm.
Garfield was very, I mean, very bag pussy, very big and jowly and
that's
different.
True, yeah.
Yeah. He's very more of a polished thing right now. But definitely get the first book and then get a more recent book and just watch and just observe the difference. And then I would head to strippedfilm.com and I would spend the money to download the Jim Davis interview. Maybe even before you sit down to read the books and watch Jim Davis talk about him growing up and having asthma and staying inside and making comics. Like, this is a cartoonist's cartoonist. He cares very deeply about the work. And it's just fascinating. And I think you'll fall in love with him as a cartoonist. And I think you'll fall in love with the strip a little bit more, even if you watch that before you read it. And if you've already read it, watch a Jim Davis interview and then reread it, because I think you'll get a different appreciation for it. I mean, I can't imagine someone who hasn't read it.
Right, who hasn't read a Garfield strip at some point.
Yeah, so if you go to strippedfilm.com, on the right-hand side, it shows you how you can purchase it. And the last choice is VHX. And if you click on that, the very first thing, for $2.99, for $3, you get the full Jim Davis interview.
That's not even the price of a latte, is it?
Not even. And boy, the nourishment you'll get from that interview over a latte, let me tell you.
Awesome. All right. That's a good place to bring this to a close, I think. Scott, thank you very much for being on the show.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for having me. I love talking about cartooning and Garfield.
Where can people find you if they like what you have to say?
The best place to go is pvponline.com. PvP is the comic strip I started in 1998. I was inspired by Jim and other cartoonists. It is my love letter to the American comic strip. I'll do it as long as my hand can draw it, and I'll post it as long as people want to read it. And it's our hub for linking to all of our other projects. So if I'm working on something or a friend of mine is working on it, you'll see it up at the top marquee. So Table Titans, Steve Hammacher's Plocks, Tavis Maiden's Tenko King, all of our friends who work with us, and all of my work can be found at pvponline.com.
Awesome. Scott Kurtz, thank you very much for being on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to Unjustly Maligned. I hope you enjoyed it, and if you did, please check out my comics, books, and music. I may not write a comic about a sarcastic, overweight cat, but I do have many rather more human-centric comics that you may enjoy. They're available at your local comic or bookstore and at online retailers everywhere. Go to anthonyjohnston.com, where you'll find information and links to all of my work. Please also consider rating Unjustly Maligned on iTunes. It is the best way to spread the word about the show and is very much appreciated. Unjustly Maligned is a 7RQ production for The Incomparable and is made in England. You can find more information, links, and show notes at ump.fm. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time. A silly thing that I realised when I was thinking about, I was like, well, hang on, when did I first come across Garfield? And it was, as I say, I don't think it ever ran in newspapers over here, but we had the book compilations. And I was actually introduced to it by a friend of mine whose name is John with no H.
I see.
And
so that was his connection to it.
Well, I've never asked him, and it occurred to me, do you know, maybe I should ask him next time I see him.
Yeah.
If there was a certain amount of identification, they're like, oh, somebody who's got the same name as me.
I honestly highly recommend downloading that interview. It's especially if you have some artwork to work on. Mm-hmm. Just put it on in the background, man, and get ready to draw three times as good as you normally do, because it's really going to charge up.
Well, I mean, I don't work on artwork, but yeah.
Oh, that's right.
But
you write.
Yeah.
Okay, so don't do that while you're writing. So is there a whole, I mean, I know Fred Bassett, but is there just a whole British comic strip
pantheon? Yeah, we had newspaper strips, but because we're such a smaller country, there was no syndication, because all of our newspapers, all of our big newspapers were national. And just, you know, because the country's small enough that you could just print them in one location and then ship them throughout the whole country. And then we had local newspapers, but local newspapers had zero budget, so they didn't run strips. They were mainly for classifieds and property ads and, you know, man burns toast sort of local news. So we just didn't have that idea of syndicated columns and features and strips. But we did have, yes, our pantheon of strips, but they were quite different. We had the Perishers, which was kind of a British version of Peanuts, I suppose.
Okay.
We had Andy Cap, which I think is known in the US. Yeah.
Oh, yes. The guy that abused his wife.
Right, the guy that beats up his wife, in the flat cabin. Yeah. But we also had, what was it? The Sun had Hagar the Horrible, who's a Viking, that sort of thing.
Yep.
But we also had adventure strips, which were more of a thing over here than I believe they ever were in the US.
Back in the day, they were pretty big, but I don't know how long they lasted.
Right. We had them for quite a long time. Yeah, things like Modesty Blaze and Garth ran for decades, decades. Mm-hmm. That was actually, for the longest time, I really wanted to do that. There was something about that format of doing the daily three-panel adventure strip in a newspaper specifically that really appealed to me. I don't really know why. I mean, the format, I still like it, but there was something about that. I remember very clearly as a kid thinking like, oh, I'd love to do that for a living. But I soon realized that I couldn't draw well enough. So, you know, I used to doodle a bit, but I was never good enough to, you know, go pro. But yeah, the strip landscape between here and the US is, I find it fascinating because it's always been so different. We have such, like, Calvin and Hobbes is just not a thing over here at all. You know?
Wow, really?
Yeah. People who know it only know it because they've got like friends in the States or something.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. We had I lived in a townhome when I first moved here to Seattle, and one of my neighbors was a British couple, and we had like a courtyard out front, and I'd walk the dogs, and we'd always talk.
Ah.
And he was a writer, and he found out I was a cartoonist, and he got really excited. He goes, "Well, you won't know my favorite comic strip growing up." And I said, "Fred Bassett." And he's like, "How did you know that?" And I said, "I don't know. It's the only British comic I really followed, because obviously I'm standing there with two Bassett hounds, you know?" And he's like, "That's incredible." He had no idea that anyone in the States knew what Fred Bassett was. And I told him, "Yeah, it ran in my paper when I was growing up, you know, in the Dallas paper." And he's like, I can't believe that. Red Dwarf, Chef.
Right.
Keeping Up Appearances.
Keep it, really?
Yeah, oh, yeah.
Wow.
We used to watch it. For some reason, our local PBS station, every Sunday night, they had a British block.
Wow.
And it was Chef, which didn't have many episodes either.
No. But Keeping Up Appearances, what a strange one to sell to the Americans.
I know, but it's a great show.
Wow.
It is 100% my grandmother, except she's German, not British, which is weird. I think my cat knows we're talking about Garfield because he is practically digging through the door trying to get into my office. He is pissed that he can't see me right now. My cat does not like closed doors. And he learned how to open doors in our old apartment because we had the doorknobs that were handles.
Oh, no.
And he could reach up and open the door, which the first time we knew he could do that in the middle of the night when our bedroom door just opened, just went, it scared the heck out of us.
Oh,
but,
wow.
In our new home, we have the round doorknobs that he can't affect, and he is pissed about it.
Oh, sorry, you mean Penis the Strip?
Oh, not penis.
No, I thought you said... I thought you meant peanuts as in...
Oh.
That you eat.
Oh. They love peanuts. I don't know why. No, I'm not having a stroke. I'm talking about Snoopy. Is it not called Peanuts there?
I think it is, but it's better known as either Snoopy or Charlie Brown, yeah.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sorry, Charles, go on.
No, it's okay. That's funny. Do not edit that out. That's very funny. Yep, animals. Always loved animals. I remember telling my mom, she's like, maybe one day you'll want to make comic strips about humans. And I'm like, no. That's stupid.